everyone. Today we are doing something different with our jury break. I've been so preoccupied lately with the idea of cult leaders, who they are, what they are, and why people follow them. The word charisma gets thrown around a lot, but what does that mean? What makes a cult leader so followable? Today we are deconstructing one man's process. We are going to look at his background, his claims, his deeds, his words, and his interactions with his followers in an attempt to glean insight into his success at this. The man is Keith Raniere, and if you haven't heard of him, you're lucky. He's the founder of a cult called Nexium, a man awaiting trial for various offenses, including sex trafficking, and a perfect dick.
I'm an interesting person. I'm a controversial person, but most importantly, I'm an unconventional person.
So let's get started. Unlike most cult leaders I've researched, Raniere doesn't seem to have had a troubled childhood. He was born in New York to a middle-class family. His father was in advertising and his mother taught ballroom dancing. The greatest controversy surrounding his childhood stems from claims he's made about it. He claims he could speak full sentences at the age of one, that he could read by the age of two, and that he was a judo master and concert-level pianist by the age of 13. He also claims he has an IQ of 240. 240. I've read several accounts, and here is my understanding of his scholastic record. He initially claimed to have graduated high school early at 16 and then achieved 3 bachelor degrees from Rensselaer Polytechnic University. Later, a news outlet debunked that claim by examining his high school record, which shows he graduated at 18. Then the narrative seems to have changed, or been clarified, depending on who you ask. Raniere said that he left high school voluntarily at the age of 16 because it wasn't challenging enough for him, and enrolled at Rensselaer because they didn't require a high school diploma. And then a couple years later, during or after his studies, he returned to his high school and got his diploma when he was 18. Here is what is and what isn't confirmed. What is confirmed is that he graduated high school at 18. What is not confirmed is that he achieved 3, or any, bachelor's degrees from Rensselaer. The record of any IQ test has yet to be found, so that's also unconfirmed. By the Fair Use Act, here's a clip of Megyn Kelly grilling Raniere's lawyer, Mark Ignifilo, about some of these claims.
What about Keith Raniere and his tenuous relationship with the truth? He claimed he graduated from high school and started RPI at age 16. That's not true.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know when he started RPI.
He claimed he could make full sentences by the age of one.
If exaggerating about one's resume is a crime, I think we're all in trouble.
No, I'm not.
I'm probably not either, but yeah. Other than the two of us.
This guy is a liar. He has a long history of lying about himself and his achievements, including his time at RPI, where he was a 2.2 GPA and not a triple major who set records at the school.
That doesn't worry me in the least.
No?
No.
The first trouble Raniere got into was in 1984, when Keith was 24 years old. He was accused by a woman of having sex with her underage sister, who was 15 years old. He said that the minor was an enlightened being, and therefore older than her physical age. He also made statements about her being a Buddhist goddess, and them needing to be together in sexual harmony, or something. Two things. One, I'm only mentioning the goddess stuff because it's been repeated by various sources, so I think it's likely true. But despite how wacky it sounds, I don't think Raniere was on drugs or confused or psychologically impaired when he claimed this. Manson is an example of a full-on nutjob cult leader, but Raniere is too calculating for this. I think it's a better bet that he used that type of insistence to work an angle and somehow evade punishment, which he did, at least for the time being. At around 30, he started a company called Consumers Byline, and the PR all said he was a genius, and it was so innovative, and everything was great. Except...
We first told you about Consumers Byline last May, when the company was accused of being an illegal pyramid scheme.
Right. So Raniere was forced to dissolve the company and pay fines, but he didn't serve any jail time. Next up came Nexium. It's spelled NXIVM, but it's pronounced Nexium, like the acid reflux medicine. He founded the company, I suppose, with a woman named Nancy Saltzman. According to their website, the organization dealt with all aspects of personality development. It offered the solutions for several complex aspects of everyday lives, such as gender, childhood development, creative expression, and compassionate ethics. Basically, it was a company that sold self-improvement courses. The company somehow was doing well, maybe due to the fact it was also a pyramid scheme, according to the Justice Department at a later date, meaning it would funnel the majority of payments for members into recruiting more members, and as a result of its success, they bagged some high-profile customers, including heiress to the Seagram fortune, Claire Bromptman, I believe two daughters of ex-Mexican presidents, and many B- and C-level actors. The most famous customer was a lead on the show Smallville, named Allison Mack. That name gets real important real fast. Smallville was a WB or CW show about the origin of Superman, like a Clark Kent teen drama. And Mac played someone or other. Who cares? So the Outer Circle of Nexium was this relatively innocuous series of jargon-infused self-improvement courses. But if you were invited to the Inner Circle, you faced horrible, horrible abuse. The Inner Circle that I'm talking about was a group called DOS, D-O-S, and Allison Mack was the leader. By the time DOS was started, she'd been a disciple of Ranier for years. She'd grown to consider him the wisest, most brilliant, most exciting person on the planet. This went way beyond self-improvement, business development courses, and straight into dogmatic worship. However, just because she was also a victim does not excuse her from abusing others. Max said DOS was all about women coming together and pledging to one another a full-time commitment to become our most powerful and embodied selves. However, it should be noted that DOS was short for a Latin phrase, which basically meant master over slave women. Allison Mack and a few others would invite women to join DOS and hold disturbing induction rituals. Women were made to strip down and sit cross-legged in a circle. They were also made to understand that from that point on, they were slaves.
And the first step is making a vow of obedience to her as me being a slave and her being my master.
Again, slave? She used the word slave?
She used the word slave.
Did you object?
Of course, yeah, and objected every stage of the way. And she said, it's a metaphor. It's a guru disciple.
Before women could join or even find out what DOS was, they had to turn over collateral. This collateral took the shape of naked pictures, embarrassing information from your past, or videos of yourself trash-talking your loved ones. This was insurance that they wouldn't talk about what happened to them. Possibly the most disturbing thing that happened to these women was a branding ritual, which Allison Mack admits was her idea. The idea of tattooing the women to pledge their allegiance was raised, and Mack wanted something more, quote, meaningful. What wound up transpiring was a sick event in which fellow recruits would hold a woman down on a massage table while someone would painstakingly and painfully brand them for 30 minutes with a symbol that was a combination of Ranieri's and Mac's initials. Sarah Edmondson is a brave woman who came forward with her story and spoke to the media about this experience. The following clip is Edmondson on 2020 describing what it was like to hold down another woman.
And the woman on the table screamed out in pain, you know, twisted and turned and yelled. And the woman I was with holding her legs down, we looked at each other and we just wept.
Why didn't you let go and run out of there even naked?
It didn't seem like a choice at the time.
This clip is from Uncover, Escaping Nexium, in which Edmondson talks about her own experience being branded.
And I was feeling pain and I had all these women around me, like, holding me. And it was like awful, and at the same time, in those moments, like, crazy intense to go through this with a bunch of women that I was, like, starting to feel close to because we're going through trauma together. Oh my God, this is crazy, and I'm also, like, pushing myself just to get through it.
Once they were slaves, these women were starved. And the reason why is that Ranieri preferred rail-thin women. And he and Mac and any other women who were involved in orchestrating this put them on 500 to 800-calorie-a-day diets, which is starvation. I recently read an article from a journalist who went on this same quote-unquote diet in order to understand what these victims experienced. I think she lasted a few days, 4 days maybe, and she said that her thoughts were totally consumed with food, what she was eating next, when she was eating next. She was lightheaded and brain foggy. In addition to satisfying Ranieri's physical criteria, this starvation clearly made the women further susceptible to control. They were made to perform, quote, acts of care, which my understanding is that for Mac, they were not sexual. At least she hasn't admitted to that yet. For Ranieri, they were almost definitely sexual acts. Branded, starved, and raped. In October of 2017, The Times published an expose about this slave ring, and Ranieri fled to Mexico, which is something every innocent person does. But he was successfully arrested and charged with sex trafficking. Those charges would later expand. So what enabled a man with a series of shitty development courses behind him, and nothing else, to accrue a harem of sex slaves? For that, I want to play some footage. There is a video online from 2017, before everything was exposed, of Allison Mack interviewing Keith Ranieri about his teachings, his philosophy, his wisdom. It's stomach-turning. And I had to watch this like 3 times, so I guess I recommend checking it out. It's such a bummer, though. Allison Mack speaks in this soft, demure voice and stares at him with big, worshiping eyes. It is legitimately unsettling. She's got this little girl demeanor about her. I know it's a gross analogy, but she looks at him like she's a little baby girl and her daddy just got home after a long day of work. Imploring, adoring eyes. One online commenter wrote, quote, "It's so weird and disturbing to see her completely transfixed and fascinated by this man who is just spluttering pseudo-intellectual drivel." Which brings me to my point. This is drivel. The man seems to talk and talk and talk and say nothing. I think his technique was to use polished words to form very vague, foggy thoughts and statements, and then allow his listeners to project whatever they wanted to hear onto that. Tell me if I'm wrong. What he's about to say is about to bring Allison Mack to tears because of how meaningful she finds it. This is Keith Ranieri answering the question, what is authenticity?
So what does it mean to be authentic? When someone's authentic, you feel them. You have this feeling of a soul there.
Right.
Not a robot, not some pre-programmed, contrived face or something along those lines. It just seems to come naturally from their experience of existing on this planet. From the time they are conceived and they become a child and grow and all of this thing, they gather this unique impression of existence. And authenticity somehow is a manifestation of all of that. And it also relates to wisdom. I always say wisdom is taking your life experience and being able to apply it in a decision. Mm-hmm. It's a global way of acting as opposed to a narrow way where, oh, I feel like doing this. I'm not thinking of anything that ever happened to me. No lessons have ever been learned. And I'm just going to go and do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, authenticity has no additional layers of artifice, no trying to be something that you think you should be. It's just a pure state of being.
Mm-hmm.
So one would say authenticity is being as you are and expressing as you are, at least to some degree. Mm-hmm. And as you are is, of course, the sum of your whole past. So when someone's being authentic, you get the feeling that not only that there's a person there in the moment, but somehow you reach into their very essence and you meet a unique individual.
Mm. I don't know why that makes me want to cry. It's beautiful.
Well, I think these are all things that we strive for. You know, we strive as a
As individuals, we strive to break through a type of existential isolation. We want to touch someone. We want to know that other people have souls. We want to experience this. We want to experience connection, things like what we call love, and compassion, and even something like, as I say, connection or rapport. Mm-hmm. Some people call it an energy or whatever, but now we're not talking to a machine. Okay. We're talking to another human. And even if that human is a machine, somehow we imbue it with, we even ask the question, is this thing alive? Is this thing thinking?
Yeah. Okay. So...
But why do you think that's...
So emotional for me?
Yes.
I don't know. I think because it seems like it's a... Something that I feel like I want it, authenticity, and I think.
Do you want about authenticity?
I think that there's a relaxed kind of exchange that happens between people when mm-hmm. there's no pretense, mm-hmm. and it seems like to me those are like the most moving, most meaningful, most important moments in life.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but why?
No, yeah, it's funny. I mean, it feels like. In a silly way, it's like, that's where love is.
That's where love is. That's going to bring us to our next clip. But before we do, I just want to talk about that one for a second. Oh my God. I feel like he said, authentic people are real and not fake. And she's like, oh my God, that's so beautiful. And then he proceeded to probe her emotionally, which I found telling. I surmised from this clip that was a tactic he used to connect with people a lot. He'd spout nonsense until someone inevitably felt emotional about something, and then he would let them inform him about what that was. What was important to them, what they were seeking, what their vulnerabilities were, and in so doing, give him the keys to manipulate and take advantage of them. I mean, I know the whole history, so maybe I'm digging too deep, but I don't think so. This feels like a born and bred predator. This guy... This was not his first rodeo, just fucking with someone. So back to love. The most disturbing portion of this interview, in my view, is what I'm about to play. Ranieri begins by discussing pain and winds up discussing love. Quick side note, an interview of Charles Manson I saw this week also showed him talking about pain, how it wasn't a bad thing, how it was useful, etc. So... just a bit of a correlation there I can't help but call out. And now this.
People perceive things in life that are very painful. And pain is considered bad. But it's not the pain that's bad. It's the suffering that's bad.
Right.
Pain is actually a very important thing. And if we look at something like love, and most people say, oh, they desire love, or in the end, they either act from love or hate, or our desire in, as humans is to be loved or to experience love. Mm-hmm. Love has been, unfortunately, the word, the concept has been tarnished. Mm-hmm. Love is something that, in the most developed human sense, the sperm and the egg, an egg does not have love, a sperm does not have love. Embryo in the womb does not have love. A newborn baby does not have love. But an old wise person has an exquisitely developed sense of love potentially. Somewhere in between being born and being old and wise, love happens. Some people think love happens at puberty because they start getting all sorts of tingly feelings, and now things feel alive. They feel like you want to consume in them, and they call that love. The nature of love, or what I might call the most developed aspect of human love, is not about just happiness, is not about feeling good. I had said the other day, I came up with a sort of a concept that love disfigures happiness. People who are seekers of happiness are actually going the opposite direction of love. And why do I say this? It's not that love doesn't contain moments of happiness or moments of joy. Mm-hmm. But the way we have a weight to our love or understand love itself or the magnitude of love is through pain. Mm-hmm. When we most feel love, we feel pain. Mm-hmm. And the depth of pain that we feel measures that love. Mm-hmm. And the depth of pain that we feel in the sacrifices that we make for love. If we look at love as some sort of transcendent human emotion, you have the body, and when you're a newborn, you don't have a whole lot of complicated emotions, but you have this body, and this body desires to eat, desires warmth, this sort of a thing. And you start to develop emotions, and you have fight or flight sort of a things. And then as you get a little older, you start to have more variety of emotions, more different types of feelings. And feelings often are just that. There are certain types of visceral somatic things that we call an emotion, and we have ideas attached to them. Mm-hmm. And we find as we become more intellectually able, we find that those ideas inspire what we call emotions, and those emotions inspire ideas. So we can walk down the street and have had an experience, as I have, with a rattlesnake, stepping on a rattlesnake, almost getting bitten, walking down the street one summer day, stepping and hearing the rattlesnake at my feet. And it's just a twig. But because of my unique experience, I go into fight or flight. I think I better run away from that rattlesnake. So it's this very interesting, complex interrelationship between this ideas, abstractions, principles, emotions that are emotions of meaning, emotions that are much more viscerally caused, and the body itself. Mm-hmm. But we say love is beyond all that. And when we say that someone loves someone, even when they speak of love in the Bible, love is beyond all those things. Mm-hmm. How do you know someone loves someone? Is it in the good times?
No.
No, it's through the hardest times. Mm-hmm. It's when there's the most sacrifice, when someone maybe is even willing to sacrifice their life for the love of their partner. And we then see. And when we see that in a movie or a play or in real life, and we let ourselves go there, we feel this deep pathos. Mm-hmm. We feel this sense of love. Mm-hmm. And love comes not from the receiving. It comes from the giving. Mm-hmm. It comes not from the satiation or the comfort. It comes from the sacrifice and the pain. Mm-hmm. That's how we know it. Mm-hmm. That isn't to say it doesn't exist in joy and in happiness, but we know it through our pain. Mm-hmm. And if you have a fear of pain, you have a fear of knowing your own love. Mm-hmm. It's not pain that is the problem. It's the suffering that's the problem. Hmm. So all of these things that we are scared of in our personality, mm-hmm. that we hold away because we're scared of the pain they might bring, mm-hmm. is a way we also limit our capacity to experience our love. Mm-hmm. So what the source ideally can do, I hope, is by broadening the person's experience of themselves, mm-hmm. and giving them, if you will, reuniting them with these fragments. And this is only part of it, but this is one of the basis that they work off of. Mm-hmm. It also increases their capacity to experience love and to grow love within their life.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. Some of this is just inane bullshit. If you want to debate whether a newborn is capable of love, ugh. But I certainly don't find it reasonable to conclude that a child is less capable of love than a senior citizen. That's just dumb. And I know this is grating to listen to, and I'm sorry, but if we can just sift beyond the pretension and focus on the content here, there is a lot of dangerous messaging. Think about the effect the following quotes from this clip would have on a woman over time before she is invited or directed by Ranieri to be branded, starved, and perform sexual favors. 1. Seekers of happiness are going the opposite direction of love. 2. We understand love through pain. When we most feel love, we feel pain. Our pain measures that love. 3. We know someone loves us during the hardest times, when someone is willing to sacrifice, even sacrifice their life. if that is drilled into you over and over and accepted by people around you that you respect, how might you internalize that? And how much more likely would you be to let someone hurt you in the name of love? This is disgusting. It's worse than just openly predatory bullshit because it's wrapped up in this guise of kindness and wisdom and even female empowerment. In the end of this interview, Allison Mack speaks to her desire to empower women and asks Ranieri for direction. I would play it, but there's just nothing there. He spends 20 minutes saying nothing, as seems to be his shtick. But one of the reasons they discuss female empowerment is because Ranieri had a course for women and women's advancement. It was called Gen S. I think that's where some of his eventual DOS members found their way into his teachings. And what somehow makes this whole thing even more offensive. Ranieri is an appalling person, but tragically, all too typical in the landscape of cult leaders. Thank you for listening. Wednesday's episode is called Lola Buys a Gun. Kyle shares his suspicions of the temple with fellow members. After they report him, Ty Byman writes to Lola personally with what she claims was a veiled directive to commit murder. See you Wednesday.